Them blue. It will be a sort of bridge between the faiths. Gently, does it? You follow? And besides, blue is a neutral sort of colour. Avoids the usual colour problems. Gets you away from black and white, yes? On the whole, I'm sure it's the one to choose. Even bishops can be wrong, the young father is thinking. But meanwhile, he's in quite a spot, because the little woman is clearly getting into a state, has begun issuing a severe reprimand through the wooden grill. What type of answer is blue, father? How to believe such a thing? You should write to Holy Father Pope in Rome. He will surely put you straight. But one does not have to be Pope to know that the men's are not ever blue. The young father closes his eyes, breathes deeply, counterattacks. Skins have been dyed blue, he stumbles. The Picts, the blue Arab nomads. With the benefits of education, my daughter, you would see. But now, a violent snort echoes in the confessional. What, father? You are comparing our Lord to jungly wild men? Oh, Lord, I must catch my ears for shame. And there is more, much more. While the young father, whose stomach is giving him hell, suddenly has the inspiration that there is something more important lurking behind this blue business, and asks the question, whereupon tirade gives way to tears, and the young father says panically, Come, come, surely the divine radiance of our Lord is not a matter of mere pigment. And a voice through the flooding salt water, Yes, father, you're not so bad after all. I told him just that. Exactly that very thing only, but he said many rude words and would not listen. So there it is. Him has entered the story, and now it all tumbles out, and Miss Mary Pereira, tiny, virginal, distraught, makes a confession which gives us a crucial clue about her motives when, on the night of my birth, she made the last and most important contribution to the entire history of 20th century India, from the time of my grandfather's nose bump until the time of my adulthood. Mary Pereira's confession. Like every Mary, she had her Joseph da Costa, an orderly at a Pedder Road clinic called Dr. Nalika's Nursing Home. Oh-ho! Padma sees a connection at last. Where she worked as a midwife. Things had been very good at first. He had taken her for cups of tea or lassi or faluda and told her sweet things. He had eyes like road drills, hard and full of rat-a-tat. But he spoke softly and well. Mary, tiny, plump, virginal, had revelled in his attentions. But now, everything had changed. Suddenly, he's sniffing the air all the time, in a funny way, nose high up. I ask, you got a cold or what, Joe? But he says, no, he says, sniffing the wind from the north. But I tell him, Joe, in Bombay the wind comes off the sea from the west, Joe. In a fragile voice, Mary Pereira describes the ensuing rage of Joseph da Costa, who told her, You don't know nothing, Mary. The air comes from the north now, and it's full of dying. This independence is for the rich only. The poor are being made to kill each other like flies. In Punjab, in Bengal, riots, poor against poor. It's in the wind. And Mary, You're talking crazy, Joe. Why are you worrying with those so bad things? We can live quietly still, no? Never mind. You don't know. One thing. But Joseph, even if it's true about the killing, they're Hindu and Muslim people only. Why get good Christian folk mixed up in their fight? Those ones have killed each other forever and ever. You and your Christ! You can't get it into your head that that's the white people's religion. Leave white gods for white men. Just now, our own people are dying. We've got to fight back. Show the people who to fight instead of each other. You see? And Mary, that's why I asked about colour, father. And I told Joseph, I told and told, fighting is bad. Leave off these wild ideas. But then he stops talking with me and starts hanging about with dangerous types. And there are rumours starting up about him, father, how he's throwing bricks at big cars, apparently, and burning bottles also. He's going crazy, father. They say he helps to burn buses and blow up trams, and I don't know what. What to do, father? I tell my sister about it all. My sister Alice, a good girl, really, father. I said, "That Joe, he lives near a slaughterhouse, and maybe that's the smell that got into his nose and muddled him all up." So Alice went to find him. "I will talk for you," she says. "But then, oh God, what is happening to the world? I tell you truly, Father, oh Baba." And the floods are drowning her words. Her secrets are leaking saltily out of her eyes because Alice came back to say that, in her opinion, Mary was the one to blame for haranguing Joseph until he wanted no more of her, instead of giving him support in his patriotic cause of awakening the people. Alice was younger than Mary and prettier, and after that there were more rumours, Alice and Joseph stories. And Mary came to her wit's end. "That one," Mary said, "what does she know about this politics? Only to get her nails into my Joseph she will repeat any rubbish he talks, like one stupid minor bird. I swear, Father—" "Careful, daughter, you are close to blasphemy." "No, Father, I swear to God, I don't know what I won't do to get me back that man. Yes, in spite of—" "Never mind what he—" Salt water washes the confessional floor. And now, is there a new dilemma for the young father? Is he, despite the agonies of an unsettled stomach, weighing in invisible scales the sanctity of the confessional against the danger to civilized society of a man like Joseph D'Acosta? Will he, in fact, ask Mary for her Joseph's address and then reveal? In short, would this bishop-ridden, stomach-churned young father have behaved like, or unlike, Montgomery Clift in I Confess? Watching it some years ago at the New Empire Cinema, I couldn't decide. But no, once again, I must stifle my baseless suspicions. What happened to Joseph would probably have happened anyway. And in all likelihood, the young father's only relevance to my history is that he was the first outsider to hear about Joseph D'Acosta's virulent hatred of the rich and of Mary Pereira's desperate grief. Tomorrow I'll have a bath and shave. I'm going to put on a brand new kurta, shining and starched, and pyjamas to match. I'll wear mirror-worked slippers, curling up at the toes. My hair will be neatly brushed, though not parted in the centre. My teeth gleaming. In a phrase, I'll look my best. Thank God, from pouting Padma. Tomorrow, at last, there will be an end to stories which I, not having been present at their birth, have to drag out of the whirling recesses of my mind. Because the metronome music of Mountbatten's countdown calendar can be ignored no longer. At Methil's estate, old Musa is still ticking like a time bomb. But he can't be heard, because another sound is swelling now, deafening, insistent. The sound of seconds passing, of an approaching, inevitable midnight. Tick-tock. Padma can hear it. There's nothing like a countdown for building suspense. I've watched my dung flower at work today, stirring vats like a whirlwind, as if that would make the time go faster. And perhaps it did. Time, in my experience, has been as variable and inconstant as Bombay's electric power supply. Just telephone the speaking clock, if you don't believe me. Tied to electricity, it's usually a few hours wrong. Unless we're the ones who are wrong. No people whose word for yesterday is the same as their word for tomorrow can be said to have a firm grip on the time. But today, Padma heard Mountbatten's tick-tock. English made, it beats with relentless accuracy. And now the factory is empty, fumes linger, but the vats are still. And I've kept my word. Dressed up to the nines, I greet Padma as she rushes to my desk, flounces down on the floor beside me, commands, "Begin." I give a little satisfied smile, feel the children of midnight queuing up in my head, pushing and jostling like coolie fishwives. I tell them to wait. It won't be long now. I clear my throat, give my pen a little shake, and start. 32 years before the transfer of power, my grandfather bumped his nose against Kashmiri earth. There were rubies and diamonds. There was the ice of the future waiting beneath the water skin. There was an oath, not to bow down before God or man. The oath created a hole, which would temporarily be filled by a woman behind a perforated sheet. A boatman who had once prophesied dynasties lurking in my grandfather's nose ferried him angrily across a lake. There were blind landowners and lady wrestlers, and there was a sheet in a gloomy room. On that day, My inheritance began to form, the blue of Kashmiri sky which dripped into my grandfather's eyes, the long sufferings of my great-grandmother which would become the forbearance of my own mother and the late steeliness of Nazim Aziz. My great-grandfather's gift of conversing with birds, which would descend through meandering bloodlines into the veins of my sister the brass monkey. The conflict between grand-paternal scepticism and grand-maternal credulity, and above all, the ghostly essence of that perforated sheet, which doomed my mother to learn to love a man in segments, and which condemned me to see my own life, its meanings, its structures, in fragments also, so that by the time I understood it, it was far too late. Years ticking away, and my inheritance grows, because now I have the mythical golden teeth of the boatman Tai, and his brandy bottle which foretold my father's alcoholic gins. I have Ilsa Lubin for suicide, and pickled snakes for virility. I have Tai for changelessness, opposed to Adam for progress. And I have, too, the odours of the unwashed boatman which drove my grandparents south and made Bombay a possibility. And now, driven by Padma and TikTok, I move on, acquiring Mahatma Gandhi and his Hartal, ingesting thumb and forefinger, swallowing the moment at which Adam Aziz did not know whether he was Kashmiri or Indian. Now I'm drinking mercurochrome, and stains the shape of hands which will recur in spilt beetle juice, and I'm gulping down Dyer, moustache and all. My grandfather is saved by his nose, and a bruise appears on his chest, never to fade, so that he and I find in its ceaseless throbbing the answer to the question, Indian or Kashmiri. Stained by the bruise of a Heidelberg bag's clasp, we throw our lot in with India, but the alienness of blue eyes remains. Tai dies, but his magic hangs over us still, and makes us men apart. Hurtling on, I pause to pick up the game of hit the spittoon. 5 years before the birth of a nation, my inheritance grows, to include an optimism disease, which would flare up again in my own time, and cracks in the earth, which will be, have been, reborn in my skin, and ex-conjurer hummingbirds, who began the long line of street entertainers, which has run in parallel with my life, and my grandmother's moles, like witch nipples, and hatred of photographs, and what's-his-name, and wars of starvation and silence, and the wisdom of my Aunt Alia, which turned into spinsterhood and bitterness, and finally burst out in deadly revenge, and the love of Emerald and Zulfikar, which would enable me to start a revolution, and crescent knives, fatal moons, echoed by my mother's love name for me, her innocent Chand Ka Tukra, her affectionate piece of the growing larger now, floating in the amniotic fluid of the past. I feed on a hum that rose higher, higher, until dogs came to the rescue, on an escape into a cornfield and a rescue by Rashid the rickshawwala with his Gaiwala antics as he ran full tilt, screaming silently, as he revealed the secrets of locks made in India and brought Nadir Khan into a toilet containing a washing chest. Yes, I'm getting heavier by the second, fattening up on washing chests and the under-the-carpet love of Mumtaz and the rhymeless bard, plumping out as I swallow Zulfikar's dream of a bath by his bedside and an underground Taj Mahal and a silver spittoon encrusted with lapis lazuli. A marriage disintegrates and feeds me. An aunt runs traitorously through Agra streets without her honour, and that feeds me too, and now false starts are over. And Amina has stopped being Mumtaz, and Amit Sanai has become, in a sense, her father as well as her husband. My inheritance includes this gift, the gift of inventing new parents for myself whenever necessary, the power of giving birth to fathers and mothers, which Amit wanted and never had. Through my umbilical cord, I'm taking in fare dodges and the dangers of purchasing peacock feather fans. Amina's assiduity seeps into me. And more ominous things, clattering footsteps, my mother's need to plead for money until the napkin in my father's lap began to quiver and make a little tent, and the cremated ashes of Arjuna India bikes, and the peep show into which Lifafa Das tried to put everything in the world, and rapscallions perpetrating outrages. Many-headed monsters swell inside me. Masked raveners, 8-year-old girls with lisps and one continuous eyebrow, mobs crying rapist. Public announcements nurture me as I grow towards my time, and there are only 7 months left to go. How many things, people, notions we bring with us into the world? How many possibilities and also restrictions of possibility? Because all of these were the parents of the child born that midnight, and for every one of the midnight children, there were as many more. Among the parents of midnight, the failure of the cabinet mission scheme, the determination of M. A. Jinnah, who was dying and wanted to see Pakistan formed in his lifetime, and who would have done anything to ensure it, that same Jinnah whom my father, missing a turn as usual, refused to meet, and Mountbatten, with his extraordinary haste and his chicken-breast-eater of a wife, and more, Red Fort and Old Fort, monkeys and vultures dropping hands, and white transvestites and bone-setters and mongoose trainers, and Sri Ram Ram Seth, who made too much prophecy. And my father's dream of rearranging the Koran has its place. And the burning of a godown, which turned him into a man of property and not leathercloth, and the piece of Ahmed which Amina could not love. To understand just one life, you have to swallow the world. I told you that. And fishermen, and Catherine of Braganza, and Mumba Devi, coconuts, rice, Shivaji's statue, and Methil's estate, a swimming pool in the shape of British India, and a two-story hillock, a centre parting, and a nose from Bergerac, an inoperative clock tower, and a little circus ring, an Englishman's lust for an Indian allegory, and the seduction of an accordionist's wife. Budgerigar, ceiling fans, the Times of India, are all part of the luggage I brought into the world. Do you wonder, then, that I was a heavy child? Blue Jesus leaked into me, and Mary's desperation, and Joseph's revolutionary wildness, and the flightiness of Alice Pereira, all these made me too. If I seem a little bizarre, remember the wild profusion of my inheritance. Perhaps, if one wishes to remain an individual in the midst of the teeming multitudes, one must make oneself grotesque. At last, Padma says with satisfaction, you've learned how to tell things really fast. August 13th, 1947. Discontent in the heavens. Jupiter, Saturn, and Venus are in quarrelsome vein. Moreover, the three cross stars are moving into the most ill-favoured house of all. Benassi astrologers name it fearfully Karamstan. They enter Karamstan. While astrologers make frantic representations to Congress Party bosses, my mother lies down for her afternoon nap. While Earl Mountbatten deplores the lack of trained occultists on his general staff, the slowly turning shadows of a ceiling fan caress Amina into sleep. While M.A. Jinnah, secure in the knowledge that his Pakistan will be born in just 11 hours, a full day before independent India, for which there are still 35 hours to go, is scoffing at the protestations of horoscope mongers, shaking his head in amusement. Amina's head, too, is moving from side to side, but she is asleep. And in these days of her boulder-like pregnancy, an enigmatic dream of flypaper has been plaguing her sleeping hours, in which she wanders now, as before, in a crystal sphere filled with dangling strips of the sticky brown material which adhere to her clothing and rip it off as she stumbles through the impenetrable papery forest. And now she struggles, tears at paper, but it grabs at her until she is naked, with the baby kicking inside her, and long tendrils of flypaper stream out to seize her by her undulating womb. Paper glues itself to her hair, nose, teeth, breasts, thighs, and as she opens her mouth to shout, a brown adhesive gag falls across her parting lips. Amina Begum, Musa Singh, wake up! Bad dream, Begum Shaiba. Incidents of those last few hours. The last dregs of my inheritance. When there were 35 hours to go, my mother dreamed of being glued to brown paper like a fly. And at the cocktail hour, 30 hours to go, William Methil visited my father in the garden of Buckingham Villa. Centre parting strolling beside and above big toe, Mr. Methil reminisced. Tales of the first Methil, who had dreamed the city into existence, filled the evening air in that penultimate sunset. And my father, aping Oxford drawl, anxious to impress the departing Englishman, responded with, "Actually, old chap, ours is a pretty distinguished family, too. Methold, listening, head cocked, red rose in cream lapel, wide-brimmed hat concealing parted hair, a veiled hint of amusement in his eyes. Ahmed Sinai, lubricated by whiskey, driven on by self-importance, warms to his theme, Mughal blood, as a matter of fact. To which Methold, no, really? You're pulling my leg. And Ahmed, beyond the point of no return, is obliged to press on. Wrong side of the blanket, of course, but Mughal certainly. That was how, 30 hours before my birth, my father demonstrated that he, too, longed for fictional ancestors. How he came to invent a family pedigree that, in later years, when whiskey had blurred the edges of his memory and gin bottles came to confuse him, would obliterate all traces of reality, and how, to hammer his point home, he introduced into our lives the idea of the family curse. "Oh, yes," my father said as Methil cocked a grave, unsmiling head. "Many old families possess such curses. In our line, it is handed down from eldest son to eldest son, in writing only, because merely to speak it is to unleash its power, you know." Now, Methold. Amazing! And you know the words? My father nods, lip jutting, toes still, as he taps his forehead for emphasis. All in here, all memorized. Hasn't been you since an ancestor quarreled with the Emperor Baba and put the curse on his son, Humayun. Terrible story, that. Every schoolboy knows. And the time would come when my father, in the throes of his utter retreat from reality, would lock himself in a blue room and try to remember a curse which he had dreamed up one evening in the gardens of his house while he stood tapping his temple beside the descendant of William Methold. Saddled now with flypaper dreams and imaginary ancestors, I am still over a day away from being born. But now the remorseless tick-tock reasserts itself. 29 hours to go, 28, 27. What other dreams were dreamed on that last night? Was it then? Yes. Why not? That Dr. Nalika, ignorant of the drama that was about to unfold at his nursing home, first dreamed of tetrapods. Was it on that last night, while Pakistan was being born to the north and west of Bombay, that my uncle Hanif, who had come, like his sister, to Bombay, and who had fallen in love with an actress, the divine Pia, her face is her fortune, the Illustrated Weekly once said, first imagined the cinematic device which would soon give him the first of his 3 hit pictures? It seems likely myths, nightmares, fantasies were in the air. This much is certain. On that last night, my grandfather, Adam Aziz, alone now in the big old house in Cornwallis Road, except for a wife whose strength of will seemed to increase as Aziz was ground down by age, and for a daughter, Alia, whose embittered virginity would last until a bomb splitter in two over 18 years later, was suddenly imprisoned by great metal hoops of nostalgia, and lay awake as they pressed down upon his chest, until finally, at 5 o'clock in the morning of August 14th, 19 hours to go, he was pushed out of bed by an invisible force and drawn towards an old tin trunk. Opening it, he found old copies of German magazines, Lenin's What is to be Done, a folded prayer mat, and at last, the thing which he had felt an irresistible urge to see once more, white and folded and glowing faintly in the dawn, my grandfather drew out from the tin trunk of his past a stained and perforated sheet and discovered that the hole had grown, that there were other, smaller holes in the surrounding fabric. And in the grip of a wild, nostalgic rage, he shook his wife awake and astounded her by yelling as he waved her history under her nose. "Moth-eaten, look, Begum, moth-eaten, you forgot to put in any naphthalene balls." But now the countdown will not be denied. 18 hours, 17, 16, and already at Dr. Nalika's nursing home, it is possible to hear the shrieks of a woman in labour. Wee Willy Winky is here, and his wife Vanita. She has been in a protracted, unproductive labour for 8 hours now. The first pangs hit her just as, hundreds of miles away, M.A. Jinnah announced the midnight birth of a Muslim nation. But still she writhes on a bed in the Nalika home's charity ward, reserved for the babies of the poor. Her eyes are standing halfway out of her head, Her body glistens with sweat, but the baby shows no signs of coming, nor is its father present. It is 8 o'clock in the morning, but there is still the possibility that, given the circumstances, the baby could be waiting for midnight. Rumours in the city. The statue galloped last night, and the stars are unfavourable. But despite these signs of ill omen, the city was poised, with a new myth glinting in the corners of its eyes. August in Bombay. A month of festivals. The month of Krishna's birthday and Coconut Day. And this year, 14 hours to go, 13, 12, there was an extra festival on the calendar, a new myth to celebrate, because a nation which had never previously existed was about to win its freedom, catapulting us into a world which, although it had 5,000 years of history, although it had invented the game of chess and traded with Middle Kingdom Egypt, was nevertheless quite imaginary, into a mythical land, a country which would never exist except by the efforts of a phenomenal collective will, except in a dream we all agreed to dream. It was a mass fantasy shared in varying degrees by Bengali and Punjabi, Madrasi and Jat, and would periodically need the sanctification and renewal which can only be provided by rituals of blood. India. The new myth. A collective fiction in which anything was possible. A fable rivaled only by the two other mighty fantasies, money and God. I have been, in my time, the living proof of the fabulous nature of this collective dream, but for the moment I shall turn away from these generalized macrocosmic notions to concentrate upon a more private ritual. I shall not describe the mass bloodletting in progress on the frontiers of the divided Punjab, where the partitioned nations are washing themselves in one another's blood, and a certain punchinello-faced Major Zulfikar is buying refugee property at absurdly low prices, laying the foundations of a fortune that will rival the Nazim of Hyderabad's. I shall avert my eyes from the violence in Bengal and the long pacifying walk of Mahatma Gandhi. Selfish? Narrow-minded? Well, perhaps. But excusably so, in my opinion. After all, one is not born every day. 12 hours to go. Amina Sinai, having awakened from her flypaper nightmare, will not sleep again until after. Ramran Seth is filling her head. She is adrift in a turbulent sea in which waves of excitement alternate with deep, giddying, dark, watery hollows of fear. But something else is in operation too. Watch her hands, as, without any conscious instructions, they press down hard upon her womb. Watch her lips, muttering without her knowledge. Come on, Slowpoke, you don't want to be late for the newspapers. 8 hours to go. At 4 o'clock that afternoon, William Methold drives up the two-story hillock in his black 1946 Rover. He parks in the circus ring between the four noble villas. But today, he visits neither Goldfish Pond nor Cactus Garden. He does not greet Leela Sabarmati with his customary, "How goes the pianola? Everything tickety-boo?" Nor does he salute old man Ibrahim, who sits in the shade of a ground-floor veranda, rocking in a rocking chair and musing about sisal. Looking neither towards Katrak or Sinai, he takes up his position in the exact centre of the circus ring. Rose in lapel, cream hat held stiffly against his chest, centre parting glinting in afternoon light. William Methold stares straight ahead, past Clock Tower and Warden Road, beyond Breach Candy's map-shaped pool, across the golden 4 o'clock waves, and salutes. While out there, above the horizon, the sun begins its long dive towards the sea. 6 hours to go, the cocktail hour. The successors of William Methold are in their gardens, except that Amina sits in her tower room, avoiding the mildly competitive glances being flung in her direction by Nussie next door, who is also perhaps urging her sunny down and out between her legs. Curiously, they watch the Englishman, who stands as still and stiff as the ramrod to which we have previously compared his centre parting, until they are distracted by a new arrival, a long, stringy man wearing 3 rows of beads around his neck and a belt of chicken bones around his waist, his dark skin stained with ashes, his hair loose and long, naked except for beads and ashes. The sadhu strides up amongst the red-tiled mansions. Musa, the old bearer, descends upon him to shoo him away, but hangs back, not knowing how to command a holy man. Cleaving through the veils of Musa's indecision, the sadhu enters the garden of Buckingham Villa, walks straight past my astonished father, seats himself cross-legged beneath the dripping garden tap.
"What do you want here, Sadhuji?"
Musa, unable to avoid deference, to which the sadhu, calm as a lake,
"I have come to await the coming of the One, the Mubarak, he who is blessed. It will happen very soon."
Believe it or not, I was prophesied twice. And on that day on which everything was so remarkably well-timed, my mother's sense of timing did not fail her. No sooner had the sadhu's last word left his lips than there issued from a first-floor tower room with glass tulips dancing in the windows a piercing yell, a cocktail containing equal proportions of panic, excitement, and triumph.
"Hurry, Ahmed!"
Amina Sinai yelled.
"Janum, the baby! It's coming bang on time!"
Ripples of electricity through Methil's estate. And here comes Homi Katrak at a brisk, emaciated, sunken-eyed trot, offering,
"My Studebaker is at your disposal, Sinai Saab. Take it now. Go at once."
And when there are still 5 hours and 30 minutes left, the Sinais, husband and wife, drive away down the two-story hillock in the borrowed car. There is my father's big toe, pressing down on the accelerator. There are my mother's hands, pressing down on her moon belly. And they are out of sight now, around the bend, past Bandbox Laundry and Reader's Paradise, past Fatboy Jewels and Chamolka Toys, past One Yard of Chocolates and Breach Candy Gates, driving towards Dr. Nalika's nursing home, where, in a charity ward, wee Willie's Vanita still heaves and strains, spine curving, eyes popping, and a midwife called Mary Pereira is waiting for her time too. So that neither Ahmed, of the jutting lip and squashy belly, and fictional ancestors, nor dark-skinned, prophecy-ridden Amina, were present when the sun finally set over Methil's estate. And at the precise instant of its last disappearance, 5 hours and 2 minutes to go, William Methil raised a long white arm above his head. White hand dangled above brilliantined black hair. Long tapering white fingers twitched towards centre parting, and the second and final secret was revealed, because fingers curled and seized hair, drawing away from his head. They failed to release their prey, and in the moment after the disappearance of the sun, Mr. Methil stood in the afterglow of his estate with his hairpiece in his hand.
"A baldy?" Padma exclaims. "That slicked-up hair of his? I knew it. Too good to be true."
Bald. Bald, shiny-pated. Revealed, the deception which had tricked an accordionist wife, Samson-like, William Methil's power had resided in his hair. But now, ball-patch glowing in the dusk, he flings his thatch through the window of his motor car, distributes, with what looks like carelessness, the signed title deeds to his palaces, and drives away. Nobody at Methil's estate ever saw him again, but I, who never saw him once, find him impossible to forget. Suddenly, everything is saffron and green. Amina Sinai in a room with saffron walls and green woodwork. In a neighbouring room, wee Willy Wink is Vanita, green-skinned, the whites of her eyes shot with saffron, the baby finally beginning its descent through inner passages that are also, no doubt, similarly colourful. Saffron minutes and green seconds tick away on the clocks on the walls. Outside Dr. Nalika's nursing home, there are fireworks and crowds, also conforming to the colours of the night. Saffron rockets, green sparkling rain, the men in shirts of saffron hue, the women in saris of lime. On a saffron and green carpet, Dr. Nalika talks to Ahmed Sinai.
"I shall see to your begum personally," he says,
in gentle tones, the colour of the evening. "Nothing to worry about.
You wait here. Plenty of room to pace."
Dr. Nalika, who dislikes babies, is nevertheless an expert gynaecologist. In his spare time, he lectures, writes pamphlets, berates the nation on the subject of contraception.
"Birth control," he says, "is public priority number one. The day will come when I get that through people's thick heads, and then I'll be out of a job."
Ahmed Sinai smiles, awkward, nervous.
"Just for tonight," my father says. "Forget lectures. Deliver my child."
It is 29 minutes to midnight. Dr. Nalika's nursing home is running on a skeleton staff. There are many absentees, many employees who have preferred to celebrate the imminent birth of the nation and will not assist tonight at the births of children. Saffron-shirted, green-skirted, they throng in the illuminated streets, beneath the infinite balconies of the city, on which little dia lamps of earthenware have been filled with mysterious oils. Wicks float in the lamps which line every balcony and rooftop, and these wicks, too, conform to our two-tone colour scheme. Half the lamps burn saffron, the others flame with green. Threading its way through the many-headed monster of the crowd is a police car, the yellow and blue of its occupants' uniforms transformed by the unearthly lamplight into saffron and green. We are on Colaba Causeway now, just for a moment, to reveal that at 7:27, the police are hunting for a dangerous criminal. His name? Joseph da Costa. The orderly is absent. Has been absent for several days, from his work at the nursing room, from his room near the slaughterhouse, and from the life of a distraught virginal Mary. 20 minutes pass, with hours from Amina Sanai coming harder and faster by the minute, and weak, tiring hours from Benita in the next room. The monster in the streets has already begun to celebrate. The new myth courses through its veins, replacing its blood with corpuscles of saffron and green. And in Delhi, a wiry, serious man sits in the assembly hall and prepares to make a speech. At Methil's estate, goldfish hang stilly in ponds, while the residents go from house to house bearing pistachio sweetmeats, embracing and kissing one another. Green pistachio is eaten and saffron laddu balls. Two children move down secret passages, while in Agra an ageing doctor sits with his wife, who has two moles on her face like witch nipples, and in the midst of sleeping geese and moth-eaten memories they are somehow struck silent and can find nothing to say. And in all the cities, all the towns, all the villages, the little deer lamps burn on windowsills, porches, verandas, while trains burn in the Punjab, with the green flames of blistering paint and the glaring saffron of fired fuel, like the biggest dais in the world. And the city of Lahore, too, is burning. The wiry, serious man is getting to his feet. Anointed with holy water from the Tanjore River, he rises. His forehead smeared with sanctified ash, he clears his throat. Without written speech in hand, without having memorized any prepared words, Jawaharlal Nehru begins. Long years ago we made a tryst with destiny, and now the time comes when we shall redeem our pledge. Not wholly or in full measure, but very substantially. It is 12:02. At Dr. Nalaka's nursing home, the dark, glowing doctor, accompanied by a midwife called Flory, a thin lady of no importance, encourages Amina Sanai, "Push harder! I can see the head!" While in the neighbouring room, one Dr. Bose, with Miss Mary Pereira by his side, presides over the terminal stages of Vanita's 24-hour labour.
"Yes, now, just one last try. Come on! At last, then it will be over."
Women wail and shriek, while in another room men are silent. Wee Willy Winky, incapable of song, squats in a corner, rocking back and forth, and Amit Sanai is looking for a chair, but there are no chairs in this room. It is a room designated for pacing. So Amit Sanai opens a door, finds a chair at a deserted receptionist's desk, lifts it, carries it back into the pacing room, where Wee Willy Winky rocks, his eyes empty as a blind man's. Will she live? Won't she? And now, at last, it is midnight. The monster in the streets has begun to roar, while in Delhi a wiry man is saying, "At the stroke of the midnight hour, while the world sleeps, India awakens to life and freedom." And beneath the roar of the monster there are two more yells, cries, bellows, the howls of children arriving in the world, their unavailing protests mingling with the din of independence, which hangs saffron and green in the night sky. A moment comes, which comes but rarely in history, when we step out from the old to the new, when an age ends, and when the soul of a nation long suppressed finds utterance. While in a room with saffron and green carpet, Amit Sanai is still clutching a chair when Dr. Nalaka enters to inform him
On the stroke of midnight, Sinai brother, your Begum Sahiba gave birth to a large, healthy child, a son.
Now my father began to think about me, not knowing, with the image of my face filling his thoughts, he forgot about the chair, possessed by the love of me, even though, filled with it from top of head to fingertips, he let the chair fall. Yes, it was my fault, despite everything. It was the power of my face, mine and nobody else's, which caused Ahmed Sanai's hand to release the chair, which caused the chair to drop, accelerating at 32 feet per second. And as Jawaharlal Nehru told the assembly hall, we end today a period of ill fortune. As conch shells blared out the news of freedom, it was on my account that my father cried out too, because the falling chair shattered his toe. And now we come to it. The noise brought everyone running. My father and his injury grabbed a brief moment of limelight from the two aching mothers, the two synchronous midnight births, because Vinita had finally been delivered of a baby of remarkable size.
You wouldn't have believed it, Dr. Bose said. It just kept on coming, more and more of the boy forcing its way out. It's a real 10-chip whopper, all right.
And Nalika, washing himself,
mine too.
But that was a little later. Just now, Nalika and Bose were tending to Ahmed Sanai's toe. Midwives had been instructed to wash and swaddle the newborn pair, and now Miss Mary Pereira made her contribution.
Go, go, she said to poor Flory. See if you can help. I can do all right here.
And when she was alone, two babies in her hands, two lives in her power, she did it for Joseph, her own private revolutionary act, thinking he will certainly love me for this, as she changed name tags on the two huge infants, giving the poor baby a life of privilege and condemning the rich-born child to accordions and poverty.
Love me, Joseph,
was in Mary Pereira's mind, and then it was done. On the ankle of a 10-chip whopper, with eyes as blue as Kashmiri sky, which were also eyes as blue as Methold's, and a nose as dramatic as a Kashmiri grandfather's, which was also the nose of a grandmother from France, she placed this name, Sinai. Saffron swaddled me, as, thanks to the crime of Mary Pereira, I became the chosen child of midnight, whose parents were not his parents, whose son would not be his own. Mary took the child of my mother's womb, who was not to be her son, another 10-chip pomfret, but with eyes which were already turning brown, and knees as knobbly as Ahmed's and eyes, wrapped it in green, and brought it to wee Willy Winky, who was staring at her blind-eyed, who hardly saw his new son, who never knew about centre partings, wee Willy Winky, who had just learned that Vinita had not managed to survive her childbirth. At 3 minutes past midnight, while doctors fussed over a broken toe, Vinita had hemorrhaged and died. So I was brought to my mother, and she never doubted my authenticity for an instant. Ahmed Sanai, toe in splint, sat on her bed as she said,
"Look, Janum, the poor fellow, he's got his grandfather's nose."
He watched mystified as she made sure there was only one head, and then she relaxed completely, understanding that even fortune-tellers have only limited gifts.
"Janum," my mother said excitedly, "you must call the papers. Call them at the Times of India. What did I tell you? I won!"
"This is no time for petty or destructive criticism," Jawaharlal Nehru told the assembly. "No time for ill will. We have to build the noble mansion of free India, where all her children may dwell."
A flag unfurls. It is saffron, white, and green.
"An Anglo?" Padma exclaims in horror. "What are you telling me? You are an Anglo-Indian? Your name is not your own?"
"I am Salim Sanai," I told her. "Snotnose, stainface, sniffer, baldy, piece of the moon. Whatever do you mean, not my own?"
"All the time," Padma wails angrily. "You trick me. Your mother, you called her your father, your grandfather, your aunts. What thing are you that you don't even care to tell the truth about who your parents were? You don't care that your mother died giving you life? That your father is maybe still alive somewhere, penniless, poor? You are a monster, or what?
No, I'm no monster, nor have I been guilty of trickery. I provided clues. But there's something more important than that. It's this. When we eventually discovered the crime of Mary Pereira, we all found that it made no difference. I was still their son. They remained my parents. In a kind of collective failure of imagination, we learned that we simply could not think our way out of our pasts. If you had asked my father, even him despite all that happened, who his son was, nothing on earth would have induced him to point in the direction of the accordionist's knock-kneed unwashed boy, even though he would grow up, this Shiva, to be something of a hero. So, there were knees and a nose and knees. In fact, all over the New India, the dream we all shared, children were being born who were only partially the offspring of their parents. The children of midnight were also the children of the time, fathered, you understand, by history. It can happen, especially in a country which is itself a sort of dream.
Enough, Padma Saksh, I don't want to listen.
Expecting one type of two-headed child, she is peeved at being offered another. Nevertheless, whether she is listening or not, I have things to record. 3 days after my birth, Mary Pereira was consumed by remorse. Joseph da Costa on the run from the searching police cars had clearly abandoned her sister Alice as well as Mary. And the little plump woman, unable in her fright to confess her crime, realized that she had been a fool.
Donkey from somewhere, she cursed herself.
But she kept her secret. She decided, however, to make amends of her kind. She gave up her job at the nursing home and approached Amina Sanai with, Madam, I saw your baby just one time and fell in love. Are you needing an ayah? And Amina, her eyes shining with motherhood, Yes. Mary Pereira,
you might as well call her your mother,
Padma interjects, proving she is still interested.
She made you, you know.
From that moment on, devoted her life to bringing me up, thus binding the rest of her days to the memory of her crime. On August 20th, Nussi Ibrahim followed my mother into the Pedder Road Clinic, and little Sonny followed me into the world. But he was reluctant to emerge. Forceps were obliged to reach in and extract him. Dr. Bose, in the heat of the moment, pressed a little too hard, and Sonny arrived with little dents beside each of his temples. Shallow forcep hollows, which would make him as irresistibly attractive as the hairpiece of William Methold had made the Englishman. Girls, Evie, the brass monkey, others, reached out to stroke his little valleys. It would lead to difficulties between us. But I've saved the most interesting snippet for the last. So, let me reveal now that on the day after I was born, my mother and I were visited in a saffron and green bedroom by two persons from the Times of India, Bombay edition. I lay in a green crib swaddled in saffron and looked up at them. There was a reporter who spent his time interviewing my mother and a tall, aquiline photographer who devoted his attentions to me. The next day, words as well as pictures appeared in newsprint. Quite recently, I visited a cactus garden where once, many years back, I buried a toy tin globe which was badly dented and stuck together with scotch tape, and extracted from its insides the things I had placed there all those years ago. Holding them in my left hand now, as I write, I can still see, despite yellowing and mildew, that one is a letter, a personal letter to myself, signed by the Prime Minister of India. But the other is a newspaper cutting. It has a headline, Midnight's Child, and a text. A charming pose of baby Salim Sanai, who was born last night at the exact moment of our nation's independence, the happy child of that glorious hour. And a large photograph, an A1 top-quality front-page jumbo-sized baby snap in which it is still possible to make out a child with birthmarks staining his cheeks and a runny and glistening nose. The picture is captioned Photo by Kalidas Gupta. Despite headline, text and photograph, I must accuse our visitors of the crime of trivialization, mere journalists, looking no further than the next day's paper. They had no idea of the importance of the event they were covering. To them, it was no more than a human interest drama. How do I know this? Because at the end of the interview, the photographer presented my mother with a cheque for 100 rupees. 100 rupees. Is it possible to imagine a more piffling, derisory sum? It is a sum by which one could, were one of a mind to do so, feel insulted. I shall, however, merely thank them for celebrating my arrival and forgive them for their lack of a genuine historical sense. Don't be vain, Padma says grumpily. 100 rupees is not so little. After all, everybody gets born. It's not such a big, big thing. Book 2. The Fisherman's Pointing Finger. Is it possible to be jealous of written words? To resent nocturnal scribblings as though they were the very flesh and blood of a sexual rival? I can think of no other reason for Padma's bizarre behaviour. And this explanation at least has the merit of being as outlandish as the rage into which she fell when, tonight, I made the error of writing and reading aloud a word which should not have been spoken. Ever since the episode of the quack doctor's visit, I have sniffed out a strange discontent in Padma, exuding its enigmatic spur from her eccrine or apocrine glands. Distressed, perhaps, by the futility of her midnight attempts at resuscitating my other pencil, the useless cucumber hidden in my pants, she has been waxing grouchy. And then there was her ill-tempered reaction last night to my revelation of the secrets of my birth, and her irritation at my low opinion of the sum of 100 rupees. I blame myself. Immersed in my autobiographical enterprise, I failed to consider her feelings, and began tonight on the most unfortunate of false notes. Condemned by a perforated sheet to a life of fragments, I wrote and read aloud. I have, nevertheless, done better than my grandfather, because while Adam Aziz remained the sheet's victim, I have become its master. And Padma is the one who is now under its spell. Sitting in my enchanted shadows, I vouchsafe daily glimpses of myself, while she, my squatting glimpser, is captivated, helpless as a mongoose, frozen into immobility by the swaying, blinkless eyes of a hooded snake, paralyzed, yes, by love. That was the word, love. Written and spoken, it raised her voice to an unusually shrill pitch. It unleashed from her lips a violence which would have wounded me were I still vulnerable to words. "Love you?" our Padma piped scornfully. "What for, my God? What use are you, little princeling?" And now came her attempted coup de grace. "As a lover." Arm extended, its hairs glowing in the lamplight, she jabbed a contemptuous index finger in the direction of my admittedly non-functional loins, a long, thick digit rigid with jealousy, which, unfortunately, served only to remind me of another long-lost finger, so that she, seeing her arrow miss its mark, shrieked, "Madman from somewhere! That doctor was right!" and rushed distractedly from the room. I heard footsteps clattering down the metal stairs to the factory floor, feet rushing between the dark-shrouded pickle vats, and a door, first unbolted and then slammed. Thus abandoned, I have returned, having no option to my work. The Fisherman's Pointing Finger, unforgettable focal point of the picture which hung on a sky-blue wall in Buckingham Villa, directly above the sky-blue crib in which, as baby Salim, midnight's child, I spent my earliest days. The young Raleigh, and who else, sat framed in teak at the feet of an old, gnarled, net-mending sailor. Did he have a walrus moustache? whose right arm, fully extended, stretched out towards a watery horizon, while his liquid tails rippled around the fascinated ears of Raleigh. And who else? Because there was certainly another boy in the picture, sitting cross-legged in frilly collar and button-down tunic. And now a memory comes back to me, of a birthday party in which a proud mother and an equally proud ayah dressed a child with a gargantuan nose in just such a collar, just such a tunic. A tailor sat in a sky-blue room beneath the pointing finger and copied the attire of the English milords.
"Look how tweet!" Leela Sabarmati exclaimed to my eternal mortification. "It's like he's just stepped out of the picture."
In a picture hanging on a bedroom wall, I sat beside Walter Raleigh and followed a fisherman's pointing finger with my eyes, eyes straining at the horizon beyond which lay, what? My future, perhaps? My special doom, of which I was aware from the beginning, as a shimmering grey presence in that sky-blue room. Indistinct at first, but impossible to ignore. Because the finger pointed even further than that shimmering horizon. It pointed beyond teak frame, across a brief expanse of sky-blue wall, driving my eyes towards another frame, in which my inescapable destiny hung, forever fixed under glass. Here was a jumbo-sized baby snap, with its prophetic captions, and here, beside it, a letter on high-quality vellum, embossed with the seal of state. The lines of Sarnath stood above the Dharma Chakra on the Prime Minister's missive, which arrived, via Vishwanath the postboy, 1 week after my photograph appeared on the front page of the Times of India. Newspapers celebrated me. Politicians ratified my position. Jawaharlal Nehru wrote, "Dear baby Salim, my belated congratulations on the happy accident of your moment of birth. You are the newest bearer of that ancient face of India, which is also eternally young. We shall be watching over your life with the closest attention. It will be, in a sense, the mirror of our own."
And Mary Pereira, awestruck, "The government, madam? It will be keeping one eye on the boy? But why, madam? What's wrong with him?"
And Amina, not understanding the note of panic in her ayah's voice, "It's just a way of putting things, Mary. It doesn't really mean what it says." But Mary does not relax, and always, whenever she enters the baby's room, her eyes flick wildly towards the letter in its frame. Her eyes look around her, trying to see whether the government is watching. Wondering eyes. What do they know? Did somebody see? As for me, as I grew up, I didn't quite accept my mother's explanation either, but it lulled me into a sense of false security, so that, even though something of Mary's suspicions had leaked into me, I was still taken by surprise when... Perhaps the fisherman's finger was not pointing at the letter in the frame, because if one followed it even further, it led one out through the window, down the two-story hillock, across Warden Road, beyond Breach Candy Pools, and out to another sea, which was not the sea in the picture, a sea on which the sails of Koli Dhows glowed scarlet in the setting sun. An accusing finger, then, which obliged us to look at the cities dispossessed. Or maybe, and this idea makes me feel a little shivery despite the heat, it was a finger of warning, its purpose to draw attention to itself. Yes, it could have been. Why not? A prophecy of another finger, a finger not dissimilar from itself, whose entry into my story would release the dreadful logic of Alpha and Omega. My God, what a notion! How much of my future hung above my crib, just waiting for me to understand it? How many warnings was I given? How many did I ignore? But no, I will not be a madman from somewhere, to use Padma's eloquent phrase. I will not succumb to crack digressions. Not while I have the strength to resist the cracks. When Amina Sanai and baby Salim arrived home in a borrowed Studebaker, Amit Sanai brought a manila envelope along for the ride. Inside the envelope, a pickle jar emptied of lime kasundi, washed, boiled, purified, and now refilled. A well-sealed jar with a rubber diaphragm stretched over its tin lid and held in place by a twisted rubber band. What was sealed beneath rubber, preserved in glass, concealed in manila? This, travelling home with father, mother, and baby, was a quantity of briny water in which, floating gently, hung an umbilical cord. But was it mine or the other's? That's something I can't tell you. While the newly hired ayah, Mary Pereira, made her way to Methil's estate by bus, an umbilical cord travelled in state in the glove compartment of a film magnate's study. While baby Salim grew towards manhood, umbilical tissue hung unchanging in bottled brine at the back of a teak almirah, and when, years later, our family entered its exile in the land of the pure, when I was struggling towards purity, umbilical cords would, briefly, have their day. Nothing was thrown away. Baby and afterbirth were both retained. Both arrived at Methil's estate. Both awaited their time. I was not a beautiful baby. Baby snaps reveal that my large moon face was too large, too perfectly round, something lacking in the region of the chin. Fair skin curved across my features, but birthmarks disfigured it. Dark stains spread down my western hairline. A dark patch coloured my eastern ear, and my temples, two prominent, bulbous Byzantine domes. Sonny Ibrahim and I were born to be friends. When we bumped our foreheads, Sonny's forcep hollows permitted my bulby temples to nestle within them, as snugly as carpenter's joints. Amina Sinai, immeasurably relieved by my single head, gazed upon it with redoubled maternal fondness, seeing it through a beautifying mist. Ignoring the ice-like eccentricity of my sky-blue eyes, the temples like stunted horns, even the rampant cucumber of the nose. Baby Salim's nose. It was monstrous. And it ran. Intriguing features of my early life. Large and unbeautiful as I was, it appears I was not content. From my very first days, I embarked upon an heroic program of self-enlargement. As though I knew that, to carry the burdens of my future life, I'd need to be pretty big. By mid-September, I had drained my mother's not inconsiderable breasts of milk. A wet nurse was briefly employed, but she retreated, dried out as a desert after only a fortnight, accusing baby Salim of trying to bite off her nipples with his toothless gums. I moved onto the bottle and downed vast quantities of compound. The bottle's nipples suffered too, vindicating the complaining wet nurse. Baby book records were meticulously kept. They reveal that I expanded almost visibly, enlarging day by day. But unfortunately, no nasal measurements were taken, so I cannot say whether my breathing apparatus grew in strict proportion or faster than the rest. I must say that I had a healthy metabolism. Waste matter was evacuated copiously from the appropriate orifices. From my nose there flowed a shining cascade of goo. Armies of handkerchief, regiments of nappies found their way into the large washing chest in my mother's bathroom. Shedding rubbish from various apertures, I kept my eyes quite dry. "Such a good baby, madam," Mary Pereira said, "never takes out one tear." Good baby Salim was a quiet child. I laughed often, but soundlessly. Like my own son, I began by taking stock, listening before I rushed into gurgles and, later, into speech. For a time, Amina and Mary became afraid that the boy was dumb, but just when they were on the verge